Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, and Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And yesterday, Amnesty International came out with a report titled Human Slaughterhouse, which documents how up to 13,000 people were hanged in secret in the Assad regime's prisons. And I'd like to get to that subject. But last night, there was a phone call between Turkish President Erdogan and U.S. President Donald Trump. And they ostensibly came to an agreement about taking on the Islamic State in the Syrian towns of Raqqa and al-Bab. But my understanding is that Erdogan issued two red lines to Washington. One, they got to stop supporting the Kurds. And the second red line that Erdogan demanded in his phone call with Trump is for the U.S. to hand over and extradite Gulen, the cleric in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania since 1999. So are those red lines acceptable to the United States? I can't imagine that they would be, just to abandon the only boots on the ground that so far have been willing to take on the Islamic State.
You know, Ian, Turkey will have a fundamentally, it will have and has had a fundamentally important role in the counter-ISIS campaign. The problem is that Turkey for the last 2 years has promised the U.S. military that if the U.S. foregoed working with the Kurds and foregoed working through the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, which is still primarily Kurdish in its makeup, but has an increasing number of Arab militias that are being mobilized through it for the campaign against Raqqa, that if the U.S. foregoed the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, that Turkey would produce enough Arab fighters to be able to have a force that could take Raqqa and could hold it afterwards. And for the better part of 2 years, in spite of all these promises that Turkey has made, these Arab fighters haven't materialized. So the irony is, Ian, that in spite of all of Turkey's promises, in spite of the fact that a number of sort of the anti-ISIS fighters that had been defeated by ISIS in Raqqa and other areas of eastern Syria and that had fled to Turkey with their families as an area of refuge, in spite of these advantages that Turkey has in order to mobilize these Arab fighters to assist the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS against Raqqa, these fighters haven't materialized, and so the only significant force of Arab fighters that is capable of working with the United States and other coalition partners on the ground are being mobilized through the factory that is the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition.
So what is the other issue, though, in regard to the safe zone? Because have the Turks closed the border to Syrian refugees trying to get in? That's what I had heard, and that seemed extremely cruel, given the fact that Aleppo has just been taken by Assad, and they're on a roll.
They have made it much more difficult for refugees to come in and for people to move from Turkey into Syria. They've made it much more difficult for that flow of people and also that flow of supplies. And the challenge with implementing a safe zone in northern Syria is that, yes, there is an area of territory east and north of Aleppo City along the Syrian-Turkish border that is under the control of the Turkish military and its local Syrian armed opposition groups that are working with the Turkish military in the Euphrates Shield Zone. And that could potentially be a type of safe zone. The problem is that, you know, what will be the local hold force to police and provide security for the safe zone? You know, there's a de facto safe zone stretching from the eastern suburbs of Aleppo all the way to northeastern Syria along the Syrian-Iraqi border. Most of that area is controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, and then the last part of that area, up to the eastern Aleppo suburbs to the western bank of the Euphrates, is controlled by Turkey. And the safe zone, that the potential area that would be the Turkish-led and controlled safe zone, the U.S. has deep concerns about what type of local rebel force would provide security, and the U.S. does not want to see extremist groups, Sunni extremist groups, moving into that safe zone and using it as sort of a refuge and as sort of a base of operations for either planning attacks against its regional partners, including Turkey and Europe, or potentially to use that safe zone as a rear base to continue attacks against the Assad government and its allies, and therefore potentially ruining any type of ceasefire that might be achieved by Russia, Turkey, Iran, and other actors.
Now, let's touch on the second red line that Erdogan issued in his phone call with President Trump. And as far as we know, the Trump administration said that they're looking into it, that our president spoke, this is their statement, the president spoke about these openly and clearly, and Trump was informed without going into too much detail. He said, let's ask our teams to work on this and let's give the necessary instructions. But the two red lines, one is to basically sell out the Kurds, and two is to hand over Gulen, who's here in exile. And that seems like a big ask to me.
They're both big asks. In respect to Gulen is a lawful permanent resident of the United States, and he's been one for the better part of 20 years. So in order to extradite him, the Turks would have to present an overwhelming case of evidence that he is responsible for extraditable crimes. And so there's a very high bar set and burden of evidence that's placed on the Turkish government, and it's been that way for successive administrations. In regard to the Syrian Kurds, the U.S. has expressed over the course of at least 2.5-3 years its desire to have a stronger Turkish role in countering ISIS, the police in the Turkish-Syrian border. Turkey, you know, has done a much better job in policing its border with Syria. But the issue for the counter-ISIS campaign, as it moves away from border areas and tries to seize ISIS's putative capital of Raqqa, is that there aren't enough Arab-Syrian fighters in the Euphrates Shield coalition that has been mobilized by Turkey to actually take the fight to Raqqa and to hold it. And then the Turks have promised the United States that if the U.S. backed off of its support for the Kurds and subsequently the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition, that it has a majority of Kurdish fighters but has an increase in number of Arab fighters in it, that if the U.S. backed off its support for the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition, that Turkey would mobilize enough Arab fighters to have a clearing and a hold in force Raqqa, and that hasn't materialized. In fact, it's been the opposite. It's the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition that has mobilized and is organizing the greater number of Arab fighters to take the fight to Raqqa. And this is an important point, because the number one commodity in the U.S.-led coalition's counter-ISIS campaign in Syria is the number of ethnic Arab fighters that can take the fight to Raqqa and to hold it afterwards. And Turkey has not delivered on that promise. And because of that, it is likely that the United States will continue to work by, with, and through the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition to accomplish the capture of Raqqa and to have an ethnic Syrian Arab hold force for the day after ISIS in that city.
And where would that come from? Jordan or some? Has anybody volunteered? So far, they've been pretty reluctant, haven't they, the neighbors?
So those are, and you know, Ian, you bring up a great point. So there's two dynamics when we talk about a hold and stability force for the day after ISIS in Raqqa. The first is, who are going to be the local Syrian partners? And what type of security force will they be able to have? What type of local council will rule over Raqqa after ISIS? And then also, will you need to have a foreign component to that whole force, whether it's American or European coalition allies or Arab coalition allies? Who will commit sort of the foreign component of that whole force until the local security and governance actors can, you know, have, you know, can be secure and stable enough in their rule that you can then withdraw the foreign force. And so, as you pointed out, we're still at a, it's still very difficult to say who among the U.S.'s regional partners will provide the forces necessary to hold Raqqa the day after ISIS. The Turks have said they would, but the Turks are very heavily invested in trying to expand their area of control in the Euphrates Shield zone that they've carved out north and east of the city of Aleppo. Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, potentially even Saudi Arabia could provide some forces. But right now it's a very nascent stage of that discussion of some sort of regional Arab hold force for post-ISIS territories.
So let's turn to the Amnesty International report, Human Slaughterhouse, that documents up to 13,000 Syrian civilians were hanged in secret Syrian prisons just outside of Damascus, the Sayed Neya prison north of the capital. Apparently there's a red building where the civilian detainees were filed through, given a perfunctory trial that lasted a couple of minutes and then hung every night, apparently. And the way that they counted the dead was by the numbers of slippers that were left on the ground. Of course, these people were then, the bodies were then subsequently buried in a military airfield. This is not surprising that anybody knows anything about the Assad regime. It's one of the most brutal regimes on the planet. But what effect is it going to have? Because there's a lot of talk within the new Trump administration of working things out with Putin. Trump himself keeps talking about wanting to work with Putin, particularly against the Islamic State. That argument falls apart because Putin, since his intervention in Syria, has not really gone after the Islamic State. He's gone after the Syrian opposition that the U.S. has supported, and Putin's objective is to keep the Assad regime in power and shore it up, and that's not the American position, or at least it hasn't been. But, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, a prominent Democratic former military officer, she visited recently with Assad. What do you think is going on there? Is there a move on the part of the United States to basically sell out the what is left of the moderate opposition and basically go along with Putin and have Assad, the butcher, reign forever?
So it's a very difficult, but necessary question, Ian, that you're asking. You know, we'll start by saying that, you know, under the Obama administration, from the beginning of the initiation of the Russian intervention in Syria in September 2015 till the end of the Obama administration this past month, you could see a movement away from Assad has to go to Assad should go. As part of a process to, well, Assad isn't the problem right now. We need to cease the fire. We need to have a ceasefire. We need to separate. We need to separate the sides from each other. We need to work out some sort of grand political bargain. And you know, as part of the diplomatic process, there were clues that the U.S. was moving away from that position, as well as some of many of its regional partners. And the fact of the matter is that as much killing and destruction as the Assad government has done to the Syrian people and to opposition-controlled areas, for the foreseeable future, the Assad government will be ruling over a statelet centered in western Syria. And that statelet has the military support of the Iranians and has the military support of the Russians. And it could, in the near future, have the intelligence support of the Egyptians and perhaps others. However, that having been said, one of the fundamental dilemmas for trying to achieve a ceasefire in Syria, and this is relevant to what is left of the moderate armed opposition in Syria, is that it still remains the position of the Syrian opposition broadly, but particularly the armed opposition groups, that Assad has to go. And not just Assad, the intelligence agencies of the regime that have conducted the most pervasive security abuses since before the uprising began in March 2011 and since the uprising began. And this is where, you know, what the recent Astana talks were very instructive, because as a result of the Astana talks, you had the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, it initiated a campaign in northwestern Syria and opposition-controlled areas in northwestern Syria against armed groups that participated in the Astana talks. And then the result of that has been sort of the creation of two broad blocks of militant extremist Sunni coalitions, one led by Jabhat Fateh al-Sham and the other led by its close and continuing ally, Ahrar al-Sham. And so for the moderate armed opposition in northwest Syria, there aren't many good options. And increasingly, there's going to be pressure to cut deals with the Assad government, perhaps in exchange for, you know, some time period of autonomy for areas that have fallen under opposition control. In southwestern Syria, on the border with the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights and with Jordan, you've had a moderate armed opposition coalition, the Southern Front, control perhaps two-thirds of southwestern Syria. But the fighting against the Assad government has been frozen since in a tacit agreement between the Russians and the Jordanians at the end of 2015. And those forces, those moderate armed opposition forces in southwest Syria, are more likely to be fighting ISIS in the near future than the Assad government. So where that leaves us, though, is that Syria is fragmented. The reality is that Syria is fragmented. And the other reality is that the Assad government will never admit that it can't reclaim the rest of the territory of Syria for the foreseeable future, and that as a result of that, you have an impasse. And so, if we look at what happened, you know, we see these reports of, you know, the Amnesty International report of perhaps up to 13,000 people over the course of 4 years being summarily executed by Hanin. You have all the evidence of the use of the Assad government's use of chemical weapons, both nerve agents and other chemical weapons over the course of the conflict, its strategy of starvation sieges of opposition communities, the very public and gut-wrenching destruction of opposition-controlled areas of Aleppo. You have this case against, you have a very strong case against working with the Assad government. I think that the big question that the Trump administration will have to answer is, you know, can it engage with Russia more productively than the Obama administration did to isolate Assad and to get Assad and core elements of his regime to the point where they have a choice between transitioning out of power and finding asylum somewhere, or losing the support of the Russians, and with the loss of support of the Russians, the great power protection the Russians have given the Assad regime. And so This is going to be a fundamental early question question for the Trump administration's strategy in Syria. National Security Advisor General Michael Flynn, in an interview with Der Spiegel in November 2015, outlined his vision of the resolution to the Syrian conflict. He said, in his, you know, Syria is fragmented. Russia is working with the Assad statelet. Russia is going to be there. Russia is going to be part of the international agreement. But he saw a Balkans-like scenario where fragmented Syria was put under various different zones of influence of foreign actors, stabilized over the course of time, and then over the long term, a political agreement would be made. And that, from his perspective, that the open question for the United States would be, could it influence Russia to draw down the Iranian presence in support of Assad, or work with or convince the Iranians to find an alternative to Assad and his intelligence state? And so we will see if the Trump administration will be able to accomplish that.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.